Welcome back to the podcast. I'm Jamie Baines. Today's guests are Tom and Jen Satterley, a husband and wife team who are also authors and the founders of the All Secure Foundation, and Virago, a division of the All Secure Foundation that empowers women to help their combat warrior heal from post-traumatic stress. I came across Tom and Jen when I picked up the book that he co-authored with Steve Jackson, All Secure, A Special Operations Soldier's Fight to Survive the Battlefield and the Home Front. I'm a big fan of fiction and non-fiction military books, so this one seemed right up my alley. Like many people, I'm fascinated by the Special Operations Warriors and have always liked learning more about them. This book was different, though. Yes, there are great stories in there about Tom's training and service, but there's a darker side to Tom that he readily admits and writes about. I finished the book in days and reached out to see if he and Jen would like to be guests on the podcast, and they agreed. Here's their interview. I hope you enjoy it. And welcome back to the podcast. Today's guests, plural, are Tom and Jen Satterley. How are you guys doing?
Oh, doing absolutely amazing. Thanks You're for having great. Us on.
Good, man. So look, I actually picked up Tom's book called All Secure. I blew through that joker probably in about 3 days. It was just some fantastic reading. Can you guys give me a little background on the book? And the title is means two different things. So it's just about yourselves and how you came to writing the book and where you got to where you are now.
Yeah, let's start with it's a cool guy book. It's not really.
It's definitely not a cool guy book. So, yeah, it was one of those things where I was in the depths of despair in my life. I was shunning everybody, everything. I was divorced 3 times, and I was just a complete and utter train wreck. And then that's when Jen met me at my worst. So it was one of those, it was part of a process of healing for us and me. And it was a year in the making before I even started, because Jen was like, we were being so overwhelmed after starting our foundation, All Secure, that we were on the phone all day long, both of us all day, just hearing these stories, and they were just similar as ours. And all the stories were similar. Like, we are not counselors. We are not, this is not what we need to be doing, but people were opening up and talking and feeling better. And so Jen's like, look, the only way to reach this many people, you know, social media is not doing it. We don't have the money to put it on TV or, you know, that's just way too expensive. She said, write a book. And I'm like, nope, not happening. I'm not a Navy SEAL. Not going to do it ever. My mates will kick my butt and talk trash for years. And it took an entire year for her to talk me into relenting due to the fact that it's just a way to reach people, you know. And the book, when you read the book's not about another cool guy, you know, kicking ass and look at me and all the wonderful things I did. There's some good stories in there to draw you in. But if you break down the book, it's really about how I screwed up and what I didn't do and what I should have done. And kind of laid it all out, all my dirty laundry tossed out there for people to see, just so they have an understanding of, well, this guy didn't have much to hide anymore. I can go to him and share my stuff, because he's not going to judge me after all the crap he's gone through and done. So, you know, it came out and we started getting a lot of reviews and raves about, man, your story is my story. Your story is my story. And Jen had started her book, Arsenal of Hope, but we named it All Secure just due to the fact that that is the first time during a mission for special operations, at least for us, that I would put a call out over the radio to hire, you know, All Secure, the target's All Secure. So that means everybody can take a pause after all that anticipation, aggression, energy. You hear All Secure on the radio and everybody can take a little light pause. Oh, okay. Target is secure. The bad guys are not actively coming at me. So now I can get to business.
And just so people understand, when Jen said it's not a cool guy book and you said it's not written by Navy SEAL, some of my listeners might not know yet what you were in your previous, before you started doing this. Can you give a background on what you were, how you kind of, what you're talking about when you say it's not a cool guy book? Because it's not. And I just want people to know that if you pick it up thinking it's like a Zero Dark 30 or another book like that, it's not. It's got some of those elements, but it's a lot bigger than that.
Yeah, it was
Well, actually, when I met Tom, I called him a Navy SEAL.
Yeah.
It's the first time we met, the first night we met, they were walking me down the hallway and they're like, you're getting ready. This is another Delta Force guy who was out, he said, "You're getting ready to meet this guy, Tom Satterly. Have you seen Black Hawk Down?" And I'm like, "Yep." And he's like, "He was in that." And I knew very little about the military when I started working, special operations especially. And so I said, "Delta Force." And he's like, "Do you not know what Delta Force is?" I'm like, "Yeah, they're like Navy SEALs, right?" It went over well.
I bet it did. And I bet a lot of people haven't really heard of Delta Force, because Navy SEALs are the ones who get all the it seems like all the movies made about them, all the books written about them. So Delta Force really isn't well known, is it, that you guys have found?
Well, you know, I was doing some research today for an upcoming event, and I literally typed in the history of Delta Force, and Wikipedia popped up, and there's more in there than I could even legally talk about. It's ridiculous. It's been filled up. So there's, you know, it's an Army-based organization. We take mainly from Rangers and SF, but we'll take anybody that goes through selection and tries out, including SEALs. We've had SEAL Team 6 guys come through, and you know, and be on our teams. I'm like, "Hey, tell me what's better, us or them?" You know, he's always, "Oh, of course us." I'm like, "Yeah, us now, right?" But everybody knows about Navy SEALs, you know, because there's so many SEAL teams out there. You got white side SEALs are like the Rangers to me, and then you have the black side SEALs like SEAL Team 6, where Delta only has Delta Force. Mm-hmm. That's it. Much smaller, more of a Navy SEALs guys hate this, but more of a mature group that they choose from. The selection process is more of a
tense
psychological evaluation, right? Mm-hmm. Versus, hey, you know that guy in the SEAL teams, and I haven't been through their selection or their hell week, you know, is they draw from, "Hey, I know that dude, he's a good dude, let's bring him in for some training," right? Kind of deal. Our guys, we've had record breakers that go through the selection course and break records. We didn't take them. They just weren't quite right, you know. And then I'm sure selection for them is an ongoing process as well. But the stress of being in the unit is one of those things where they have the saying, selection is an ongoing process. It's every day you swipe your card to go to work and it turns green, you're in. If it turns red, you know, you're like, "What? Okay, what did I do?" You know, so it's that stress every day. But I think the differences are the selection processes and obviously the missions. But and the age from which they pull from.
What did you do then?
And what? Oh, what?
Back to what did you do while you were in?
Yeah, I mean, when I chose to go in, it was just one of those lucky happenstance things. People were, you know, "Hey, I met somebody when I was going through the qualification course to be a Green Beret, and two people had noticed me, like, 'Hey, you, we think you have what it takes to be in the unit.' You know, this is language school time. 6 months later, selection process. You know, I went and made that. Did the 6 month train up course, and then, you know, now they're like, 'Hey, you're 18 months probation, don't do anything wrong or you're out of here again.' I'm like, "Man, this is some stressful living." But you know, I did pretty much everything in the unit, from being a nobody carrying a you know, just a gun, to being the breacher, to team sergeant, troop sergeant major, squadron sergeant major, and two different squadrons. So you know, I kind of spent 20 years there, which is just the kind of a normal career. And I don't even know. It's real normal. Well, I mean, a normal Army career of 20 years. Not, I spent 20 years specifically in that organization, just due to the quality of the people.
And you mentioned specifically in the book that, and you just brought it up just a second ago, that you're always, I guess, selection is never over. It's always, you always need to, you mentioned prove yourself, seems like every time. And the older you get, you keep up and prove yourself. So I can imagine how much so stressful that is for you.
It's horrible. You don't know when you're in. You're enjoying it. You know, you love it. Even ask me now, you know, "Hey, would you trade it all away? Would you give it all away?" I loved the missions. I loved the men. I loved the stress. I loved the pressure. I loved the challenge. But it destroys you. If you don't take care of yourself, it destroys you. So, I mean, being in the unit was a wonderful thing. And I look back on it fondly, but it will destroy you and take away everything if you let it. You know, not everybody comes out of there trashed and destroyed, but many do, just due to the fact that they don't take care of themselves on the other side.
And do you realize it's happening? Because I know you had Jen, I'm sure, helped you realize it was happening as well, because she saw it firsthand, and I think pulled you back from the brink a few times, correct?
Yeah, I think even this morning it was it's a difficult thing that, you know, to give your best every day and to be judged every day and assessed every day, it drives you, it drove me to the brink of I'm not good enough ever. Right? You're always competing. You're always trying to stay on top. You're always trying to, I don't know, be accepted at work and be good. And even if you're the last guy at work, the worst guy at work, you're still the best guy anywhere else. Mm-hmm. But that's not how you think there. You want to be the best where you're at. And every single day of my life, mainly after Somalia, I put my head down and all I did was want to be better at whatever I did, not at home, but at work, at those things that I thought would get me or someone else killed. And so teaching my brain every day that I need to keep doing better. I need to be better. I need to be better. I was really teaching myself, you're not good enough. You're not good enough. You're not good enough. And I, you know, I brought that out of retirement. I didn't know it when I was in. You have the camaraderie, you know, the team, the boys are there. They're always there. And I would throw away a wife quicker than I would, you know, it's me or the unit. I'm like, I'm gonna see ya. You know, I, you know how hard I worked to get here. And I just, it was a one track mind for me and a lot of guys, but it wasn't really recognized until that tribe is gone and you realize you were just a number. And then maybe you feel jaded, or maybe you just want it. And then all these things start piling on and you feel worthless. You feel like you're done with your reason to be on this earth. And then I met Jen. I was at my lowest, my largest, my weakest in life. And she accepted that. And to me, I thought, what's wrong with you? Why are you so nice? What do you want from me? Why are you being so nice to me? You know, and then you realize I've spent my last 22 years in a world that nobody's nice to you. You know, you razz each other daily and fun and it's great. And you're friends and mates, but nobody's really, truly giving nice. And, you know, that's when I started crashing, thinking, man, I'm a horrible human being. I am a horrible, horrible human being. My time on this earth is done and I shouldn't even be here anymore. Kind of like they broke the glass and I ran out my worth and you can't put me back in the bottle, you know?
And if you could talk about it, you had some suicidal ideations as well, correct? In fact, one very moving scene of the book was, I think Jen had left you in the car and gone to the hotel.
Yeah, that was my first suicidal ideation slash near attempt. And it hit me in a couple of blocks. It was just, I went from my job kind of sucks now to what I'm doing post-service to I'm no longer worthy of being here. My son doesn't talk to me. I'm getting a divorce and life is over for me. And I just decided when, you know, she left the car and walked on in, I was like, I'll be in a minute. I got to call somebody or something. And I, you know, and I was going to take my own life. And she just, after a bit of time, she started texting, calling. And finally texted, you're late. And I think I just felt like, oh, bullshit, I'm never late. You know, right. I took off. Here my weapon, took off. And I told her about it sometime later that, you know, hey, that day, you know, when you were texting me in Ohio, you know, I was going to kill myself. She's like, what? And then, you know, it's happened. I don't know how many times it happened since then. That wasn't the only time, but that was the start of her, I think, watching me and paying attention and realizing, man, he is not just hiding things. He's really hurting deep. And then her working with so many other special operators, she realized they're all the same. They're literally all the same. They all suffer in silence. And so she got to work on how to start fixing that. That was her kind of her new path ahead.
Well, and then she kind of opened the floodgates when she asked about Mogadishu, correct?
Yeah, she likes to talk. She likes to chit chat about things and get to know me.
And actually, part of the book, well, at least a few, which is a chapter, Jen, is written on your side of it, correct?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's you know, a lot of that is her side of it, of how she got me to crack open a little bit and how she got me to start thinking about what I was doing and my behaviors and really someone I cared about enough more than myself to take action on my poor behavior.
And, you know, honestly, he hadn't talked about Somalia. It was the 20th anniversary of Black Hawk Down. And so I asked him, are you okay talking about that? And it was like, psh, I don't care. You know, one of those, go ahead. And I don't even remember, I had asked one or two questions, maybe after the second one, I could visibly see, you know, his hands started shaking, his face started to fall, he started to cry, and I thought, oh my God, what did I just do? But everything inside me just told me to shut up and don't try to make it feel better. Don't try to, you know, brush it off. Every part of me wants to do that. It's okay. Don't worry about it. And, oh gosh, I'm sorry. We could talk about something else. But for one time I didn't do that. And I just sat and it was probably 15 minutes of him just crying and getting it out. And it wasn't comfortable. I tell people all the time, it's not like sitting in that is comfortable, holding that emotional space for someone, but it's so incredibly necessary to do for someone if you care about them. And I did. And so, you know, I think if anyone's listening and they're trying to figure out how to do that and hold that space, it's just being quiet and attentive and allowing somebody to feel what they need to feel without correcting it or making it okay for them. And he needed that.
She let me sit there and cry in the public.
Yeah.
I was like, what are you doing to me?
And it hasn't been smooth sailing for you guys, at least initially. Like, I remember another moving part of the book was on the wedding day at the beach.
Yeah. That was one hell of a day. That was the day that I pulled out a jackhammer and said, don't tell me I'm at rock bottom. You know, I'll tell you, mm-hmm. I'll go deeper and mm-hmm. tell you when I'm at rock bottom. And, you know, and alcohol and that day and the stress of getting married and the stress of, I know I'll screw this up. I know I'm going to screw this up. And the lack of trust I had in myself. But I love this woman. I wanted to marry her, but I knew I would screw it up. And so therefore I manifested that entire day and it aired out that night in a huge fight. You know, I was drunk. I ended up waking up the next morning on the floor looking around like, oh, shit. You know, I go, I've done number four, mm-hmm. all in and out, all in one night. And there was no way anybody would be married to an animal like me. And she sat there and she didn't give me that it's okay thing again. She let me sit there in my stupidity and misery and slobbing, begging her. And she's like, I don't know. I don't know. We haven't even turned in the paperwork, you know, from the chaplain to the government yet to stamp that as official in their eyes. And so I'm going to fly on home to St. Louis and think on this, you know. Oh, my God. And she said, but you need help. And so that's the very second I thought to myself, I can't quit screwing around. I got to go get help. I'm ruining my life. And I can see it playing out in front of me, and I would be a fool to keep my hands off of the steering wheel. You know, it was mm-hmm. just—I was letting it take me wherever it would take me. And so that Monday, I think I got in that day. Anger management with Eric Clapton's former therapist, which was needed, I guess. And you know, that's the first time somebody told me, because the Army had told me you don't have post-traumatic stress. I'm like, oh, good to go. Thank you. You know, you get 10% for some arthritis in your hand or some shit. And I'm like, oh, 10% after 25 years. That's awesome. And I didn't care. I really didn't care. And he said, you have post-traumatic stress, and it comes out as anger and alcohol, you know, ism, and you just kind of have anger issues, sure, but it stems from post-traumatic stress, and you need to get to work on that. And that's when Jen's like, oh, there's something to look at. So she got busy. We got busy. And it was such a difficult journey that, you know, that's when we kind of turned it into, well, she turned it into, let's do a nonprofit. Let's make a foundation to help other people who are going through the same thing we're going through.
And what is your foundation?
It's called All Secure Foundation. And we literally, well, we do counseling 365 days a year with our coaches. We have three. We're looking for four now, licensed clinical social workers that coach special operations warriors and their spouses. And we run retreats each year, intensive four-day retreats for eight to 10 couples that come in. And we travel around and speak at military organizations to talk to the newer generation about what to expect. And when the older generation says, shut up and rub dirt on it, that gives you an infection and not to listen to those guys, because that's what we all did. And it's destroying us, and that you can still be a better warfighter and have your mental health all at the same time if you know about it and get to work on it.
And bringing the spouses in, that was a different viewpoint, wasn't it? Because generally you hear a lot of times about, you know, the service members who get the help, but not much is mentioned about doing the same for the spouses.
That was Jen's idea of, you know, I had a lot of people like, hey, let's go on a hunting trip. Hey, let's go to, you want to go to Disney? You want to go diving? I'm like, yes, yes, and yes, I'll do. Those are free trips. great, you know, and you get the camaraderie and you get to connect and talk. But there's not much healing in that unless it's structured. And you go back home and your spouse is still there like, I'm glad you got another trip. I'm glad you got to go fishing. I'm glad you got to Disney. You know, and now you're home and we're fighting again, right? So now you have this battle buddy at home that doesn't understand you, doesn't know what you're going through. And there you go off to that mistress, the military again, and have fun with your secret boyfriends. And then you come home and they're like, well, our relationship's still the same. And by the way, I was here all of those years with you, holding down the fort and doing all of the struggles. And so she wanted to bring in, equally bring in. And if the warfighter doesn't want help or feels he doesn't need help, the spouse can still come to us no matter what.
That's an amazing just insight into something that was there the entire time, but nobody seemed to really latch on to it.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of been the way of the military. The spouse is at home, and a lot of it has turned into how we treat them, you know, and a lot of terminology we hear is, you know, first wife, worst wife, dependipotamus, this and that. And it's horrible saying that.
I hadn't heard that one before.
Imagine, I hadn't either until somebody told it to me.
A dependipotamus, nice.
Yeah, imagine your spouse hearing that. Imagine them feeling that way. And mm-hmm. then you go home and have a good life, you know, and then you go back to work. So, of course, when your relationship's struggling because you don't know what to do, because you've never worked on a relationship, you've never studied how to be in a relationship, you've never studied how to have a communication with someone deeply and calmly, you've been trained and rewarded for being aggressive and violent. Mm-hmm. And then we go home and wonder why we can't have a conversation with our children and our spouses without freaking out. And so we tell everybody that you don't need help. You know, you're not coming for help. You're coming for training because you've never been trained on this before. Mm-hmm. So you don't need help. You need train. Just like I didn't help you learn how to shoot a pistol. I trained you to shoot a pistol. You didn't previously know how to do that. So if you previously have never known how to be in a healthy relationship and communicate, then we're training you on that. And if you've been trained on that previously, then we're going to retrain you on that. And the same with mental health.
And Jen, you said you didn't come from necessarily military background. So how did you manage to not only adjust to it, but thrive and accomplish what you guys have accomplished and continue to accomplish, by the way?
I'm a little bit crazy too, I think. I don't know. Be a little bit off myself.
Does that help? Is that what?
Yeah, always helps a little bit.
Yeah.
My dad was Air Force. He was out before I was born. My brother left when I was 10 for college, and then he went off to the Air Force. So we have a very patriotic, you know, God-loving country kind of family, but my dad never talked about his time in service. Like I said, my brother was gone to South America here or there. And it was always really stressful for me as like a sister, you know, not knowing where he was and what he was doing. But that's about the extent that it went for me. I worked in the creative arts, so completely opposite world. And so at 36, when I met Tom, started working as combat camera and special operations. I did stateside realistic military training. I mean, I was totally in a completely opposite world from where I just came from. I lost friends. I had people confused what I was doing. I think I probably went through my own transition from art girl in this film photography creative arts world to the military world. It was tough. There was a lot of like, who am I really? What identity am I? And I think breaking free of that really helped me grow so much that I was able to just start taking people for who they are versus the box that they're supposed to be in, and learned so much in those 3.5 years working with special operations. Just every preconceived notion blown out of the water, every prejudice or thought I had was gone, and just ended up absolutely loving, adoring these men and women who sacrificed so much. And honestly, once I started seeing the training, seeing these young men come in at 24, 26 years old, seeing them on an iteration, they'd come back to us maybe a year later, ready to go on another deployment. And I'm like, has it been 10 years? Like, this guy looks like he's 36 now. Mm-hmm. I could see the stress. I could see the pain and hurt. And I could see the mask that's being thrown up too. And really, honestly, towards the last year when I started asking guys, hey, how can I support you? What can we do? 9 out of 10 said, I don't know how to be a good husband and I don't know how to be a good father. I just don't know how to be a good human, really. And nobody's teaching us that. And every time I go home, I want to head back overseas because I'm more confident overseas. Mm-hmm. I know what I'm doing. I've got my team, but I'm super screwing up at home. So I knew that we had to address the family. I started talking to spouses. Most of them felt like I did, frustrated, confused, isolated. Half the time you're wondering if you're crazy for being in a relationship that, you know, all the magazines growing up told you was a toxic relationship. You fill out the little forms and you're like, oh yeah, I've got all of them are red. So there's a lot of support that needs to happen on the other side too, for the spouses and significant others, the children, the family, because they're serving too and they're sacrificing as well.
And you guys, when you began, I remember, again, I keep quoting the book because I like it so much. You began talking to people on the phone constantly. People, it would, like, you kind of open the floodgates when you talk to one person and they talk for a long time. And I remember in some of Tom's part of the book again about how often you would talk to people on the phone, just constantly, constantly, constantly.
Yeah. It was like I was on the phone 11 hours a day, 12 hours a day, probably 5-6 days a week. And I realized it was a problem when my daughter said, you know, something about like, can we watch a show or something together? Or can we do something? And I'm like, yeah, sure. And she said, can you please leave your phone in the other room? And I looked at her and she said, you always have your phone in your hand. And that's when I realized, like, oh gosh, I'm doing the same thing. I'm putting work, you know, and everyone else ahead of my own family, which is what we lecture not to do.
Right.
So
right.
I had to do some readjustment myself. But yeah, it was honestly a gift that that these war fighters felt comfortable enough to share some of their darkest, deepest secrets with me. And I take that very seriously, and I'm honored that they felt comfortable enough. And now I'm just glad that we have coaches that can help hear those stories and help turn those stories into understanding the positive sides of them and helping the growth, which can come. I mean, Tom is a completely different man than he was 10 years ago. So it's possible. It's possible to heal.
And is it still hard to get the operators to talk about you know, where they are, what's going on, the deepest, darkest secrets, like you said?
Yeah.
Every day. It's like pulling teeth, like pulling wisdom teeth. I'm all right. I'm like, come on, man. 20 years of this and you're all right. Come on. You know, I know, I've seen your relationship. I see what you're doing, you know, right. You're drunk right now kind of thing. And not that being drunk's like horrible, but every night drunk kind of thing is,
yeah,
it's like in the next day when you're sober, it's, we don't hear from you until, you know, 7 o'clock when you start to feel good again and sad again and then open up. But, you know, I watch it happen to guys. I lived it, wrecking our lives, not making those changes, not understanding it's biological and it can be fixed, and you're behaving like you think you need to behave, and you cannot stop it without making a change. Behavioral change needs to, you know, you have muscle memory, right? Mm-hmm. I default to getting big and dominant and loud when I talk, and it's hard to break. I do it every day, and every day I try to break it still to this day. It's a difficult thing for me to not get triggered when I'm embarrassed or ashamed, and then to get dominant and big and try to win. That's not how you stay in a relationship. You know, when you get to the point of, I'm no good for this relationship, I need to leave this relationship because I love you so much, I don't want to ruin you. And they're like, no, I love you. And I'm like, you're too much in love to understand, you know? And it's that deep of a fear that I don't want to hurt you, you know, and we hear it all the time. I lived it. It's just, we want to help those people understand you can get to work. It will get better, you know, and it will take time. You have to be patient and diligent.
I think honestly, a lot of the war fighters were willing to share their stories with me is because I was anonymous to them. They didn't, you know, some of them knew me from like the exercises that we would go on, and I would talk to a few of them, but really it was, oh, you were just on the SEAL iteration. I've got another brother. Can you talk to him now? Now can you talk to him? Yep. Now can you talk to him? Sure. And it wasn't till I got to a spouse that she said, why is my husband okay sharing this stuff with you? And we had a good talk. And I said, because he doesn't know me from anything. I'm a voice on the other end of the phone. He hangs up. He got all of that out. And he doesn't have to deal with me or look at me again. What I came to realize was it wasn't that these men felt that their wives couldn't handle the blood, the gore, the guts, the traumatic story. What they were afraid of was that their wife would look at them differently after they told them. So after I've done this horrific thing I did in wartime, or, you know, law enforcement, the same thing, this thing that I had to see or do, I'm afraid you're going to look at me different. And that's why so many people are afraid to share their stories with people they care about.
That's a great point. She brings up law enforcement. I tell veterans all the time in active duty, this is not relegated to you guys. This is not your specific issue here. You know, anybody under serious stress and people who see horrible things on a daily basis suffer the exact same way.
And when these guys call you, do you have to, I guess, I don't want to say pry the information out of them, because you said you're there to listen to them. Are they ready to spill their guts when they call you?
Yes.
No, they're so ready.
When we started, it was, we would call people, like spouses, you need to call my husband. And I stopped doing that immediately when I got my ass chewed over and over again. Like, who told you? And I'm like, oh, no, I'm never doing that again. I've been yelled at by wives. I've been yelled at by husbands. I'm like, I ain't happening again. People are like, you got to call so-and-so. He's really drunk right now, and I'm afraid he's going to. And I said, call 911. Call a cop. Get him arrested. So I'm not 911. Our foundation's not 911. I'm not a counselor. I'm not going to get myself in that position and hurt somebody. You know, I can share my experiences. Mm-hmm. I can be a lighthouse to show you where the danger is and the way to go, right? Here, come this way. We'll help you. But you have to be the one to reach out. And so when they reach out, it's because they're ready. And when they do reach out and make that phone call themselves, it's easy then for us. It's hard for them, but it's easy for us to understand what they need and help them, because,
man, there's full minute or two. You'll sit there sometimes and it'll just be, you could tell they're crying on the other line because they've held it in for so long that just uttering the words and starting the story is so difficult. Tom and I have often said, like, I'm here. I'm still here. I'm not going to hang up the phone. You take as long as you need. You know, I've got you. Because it's such a release, and it's so incredibly powerful to do, is to share your story.
And is there any shame for them when they do cry, or are they at the point where they needed it, and like you said, you're anonymous, and it's just, it's a release for them?
I think there's initial embarrassment. I don't know if I'd call it shame. I think they already had shame on themselves the whole time, but I think it's the embarrassment of, like, for me, crying in front of somebody, then once you do it and it feels good, it's like, then, you know, the floodgates and the sobbing starts, and I'm, you know, ugly crying. I don't know how many times I've ugly cried now, and I don't care if anybody knows about it. You know, I've talked to other people on our podcast as well, and other tier one guys like, yes, I'm crying. Rick Hulk's crying. And I'm like, oh, so we're all getting to that point. And I crack jokes, talking to hundreds, 200 people in a room. And I'm like, and I say things like, does anybody find themselves overly emotional? And they're like, yeah. And I go like, no, I watch home improvement shows. And when they do the big reveal in the end, I start crying a little bit. They're like, yeah. And I go, that's weird, isn't it? Like, yeah, that's weird. I go, welcome to your emotions, right? They're going to come back. They're going to flood you until you regulate and understand them. But it feels good. I think it's embarrassment, but I think they warm right into it, and it makes them feel good.
The stuff you guys do is just incredible. I just, you know, it, you know, I don't know. It's like there really isn't much transition between from the operator side to the civilian side. The Army doesn't necessarily prepare you guys for that, correct?
No, it's like a big boot on the butt. Later, you know, see you into the tiger pit of civilians who look at you like a big old cut up, rotten, old, slow piece of meat, and they're like, oh, let's mess with this guy. You know, and things we run into are, you know, in our job in the military, our craft was dominance and aggression. And I'm going to overwhelm you with aggression and violence, right? And that's how I win. And then you enter the civilian world, and it's knowledge and conversation, and how can I out-talk you, you know, because you can't beat me up. This is not what we do here. And immediately, like, a veteran will go, oh, yeah, I'll knock you out, man. You know, and it's like, everybody's like, whoa, whoa, it's a crazy person. It's like, well, he's using his craft and you're using your craft. He has no other craft. So the veterans, people that get out, need to realize you need to learn a new craft of conversation, because you're not going to get in fistfights all the time. You're not going to shoot somebody into submission. You know, you're going to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're better at it, don't sit there and get mad and frustrated and scream and spit while you talk. Learn to talk like them, you know, study the enemy, if that's what you want to call civilians now that you're out, even though you're one now yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the realization of I've entered into my normal tribe again. And I, my job in this tribe was military, just like, you know, thank you for your service, put you on a pedestal. A lot of guys get mad about that, but honestly, it kind of puts you on a pedestal. And some guys like complain about, where's my 10%? You know, when they order a coffee at a restaurant, I'm like, whoa, it's embarrassing, man. Well, give me my 10% off. You know, it's like, come on, dude. Do you go out and thank the garbage guy at 3 a.m. on a Thursday when he picks up the trash? Because if the garbage guys didn't pick up our trash, this society would go down faster than the military could let it go down.
Right.
So consider who, consider your job in your tribe, and consider your importance level is that of everyone else's importance level to maintain the tribe, and just accept that.
What do you guys
keep the F-bomb out of parent-teacher conferences? It doesn't go well with the kindergarten teacher.
Is it, that's a key point. That's a tip.
Yeah, there you have it.
F-bombs, those go hard out here.
Yeah.
So what do you guys think the solution to that is? Will the military come around to realizing that there needs to be a transition between military and then civilian life? Or I'm sure people have talked about it before, and you guys, I know, see it all the time. Do you think that
they realize
that? Yeah, they know.
They know.
They've turned the ship in the ocean, right? The captain has turned the ship, and now it's going to take about 5 to 10 years for that ship to make that turn. You know, they've been working on this since they realized there was a problem. They started programs after years of talking about how we're going to start programs, because it's the government. After years of, okay, now that we've talked about starting programs, let's talk about how we're going to start these programs.
That might last another year.
That's another couple of years. And we've entered into those meetings with the government and the left and not gone back, because it's repetitive meetings to have meetings. You know, Jen and I just decided we're going to just get to work. We're going to be like special operations, light, fast, small, and active and able to move instead of being burdened down. And generals have told us, don't get into the system because it'll clog you down. Just, I think that's what's great about nonprofits out there that are helping active duty and veteran service members and their families in any capacity, because it's instant, it's now, and you don't have to wait. And, you know, and with so many people complaining about the VA, yeah, we don't have to report to your leadership as well. So you can go get help without worrying about losing your job, losing your clearance, you know, and it's changing.
Yeah.
There are people talking about it. I'm impressed with where we've been at in the last year and a half with who the Joint Chiefs or what the Joint Chiefs are talking about and healthcare and how they're working it. But there are so many veterans, and the war just shut down on, you know, on the last day. That's it. It's over. We're all home now.
Mm-hmm.
You got 20 years of veterans going, what do I do with my hands? I think I'll be mischievous. You know, it's idle time in those empty hands.
Yeah. You're not putting me back in the box.
So we've got to re-educate them and retrain them on how to live back again in the societies. When you look at special operations over 20 years doing, you know, the 1% doing 99% of the jobs for 20 years, and the military deciding that, wow, special operations is light and fast, and they look how good they're doing. Everybody's now special operations, and you guys are always going to work. You're always going to work. So they are going back to
more specific
the normal kind of way that they used to operate, because everybody was doing direct action. Everybody was chasing every bad guy, and everybody was doing it every night, and it was fun, but it wore everybody out. Now we have to get back to our legacy missions of nation building and training versus the go-getters, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, kind of closing out, what advice would both of you give to the war fighters coming out and their spouses?
I'll start with the warfighters. Yeah.
Good. Yep.
When you get out, understand you're going to need to transition, and you're going to need to get to work, and it's going to be difficult. Open your eyes and become aware of what you're doing. I wasn't aware of what I was doing. I was just oblivious to it. I didn't even want to look at it, right? I knew I wasn't a great guy, but I didn't want to admit it. Just get to work. When you get out, or I'll tell you what, before you get out, while you're in, go get help. Right? You maintain your pistol by going to the range throughout the weeks. You maintain your close quarter battle skills by doing that over and over again. You maintain whatever job you do by practicing it. If you don't practice your relationship at home, you don't work on your mental health and how to communicate with your spouse, it's going to falter and fall behind, and you're going to grow apart. If you want to grow together with that person that won't always be there like you think they will always be there, oh, they'll always be there, work to give them that good life too. Have those conversations. Work on yourself. Work together with your spouse to be a stronger relationship while you're in, so when you get out, you can you already have those tools to work together. Don't wait till retirement. And for the spouses, I'd say take an active role.
Yeah, yeah. I would say that when you're in and out, transition is, it's a difficult thing. It challenges your ego, who you are. Most military members, like anything else I just talked about as a photographer, I identified with my job. When you leave that, you have to have a very good sense of who you are, as a person, as a human, not attached to your job. That's difficult work. And there's so many organizations to help with that, us included. And I would say, do that work, find that next passion, find that purpose, and really understand that you've been trained really well and you can be very successful on the other side too. Civilian life is just another challenge. That's all. And it can be conquered. You're looking at me like you want to say something.
Oh, I always want to talk. It's like, use your support staff, right? Everyone's talking about, you know, the door kickers didn't win the war alone, right? So you're not going to win the after battle alone. Use your enablers, use your support staff to do those things and help you with those things you don't know about, i.e. coaches and counselors.
I would say to the spouses to also arm yourself with knowledge. Knowledge is power. There's a book called The Body Keeps the Score, and it lays down what PTS is, how it manifests, and what to do about it. And I think that was the first book I read back in maybe 2014 that really helped me understand what was going on at home. So to every warfighter, law enforcement, first responder, pick up The Body Keeps the Score. It will definitely change things for you. And to the spouse, do the same thing and go through this process together, understanding it's going to take patience and diligence and some forgiveness.
And if you're not working to bring people together, you're wrong.
Excellent. Well said. Well said. Where can people find you? Where can people find your organization, your nonprofit? Where are you guys at?
We are at allsecurefoundation.org. And on the social media platforms, we're All Secure Foundation as well. So real easy to find.
Guys, I really appreciate you guys coming on. Like I said, the book was very much eye-opening. I recommend it to anybody to read. And it's not, like you said, it's not the superhero book. it's so all-encompassing. It's just fantastic. And I really appreciate you guys coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Jamie. I really appreciate you having us on. And thanks for your comments on my book as well.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
All right, you guys take care.
All right, thanks, you too.
All right, see ya.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's it, guys. What'd you think of Tom and Jen? I think most people idolize our special operations warriors, and rightly so. They're out on the front lines and beyond, keeping not only Americans safe, but people from other countries as well. But what most of us don't think about is the effect that their service has on their mental and physical well-being, not to mention the physical and mental well-being of their spouses. I strongly recommend reading All Secure and then Jen's book, Arsenal of Hope, Tactics for Taking on PTSD Together. You can find Tom and Jen at the links below, and I hope you take some time to do so. We're all in this world together, so let's take care of one another. Until next time, thanks for listening.